Welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, where we go inside what makes a coach a coach. The Guardians of the Game podcast is a production of the National Association of Basketball Coaches and Learfield IMG College. Brought to you by Wilson, proud to be the official basketball of NCAA March Madness. Shop the official NCAA game ball on Wilson.com. Now, here's your host, Tim Doyle.
Welcome back to another episode of the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. I'm your host, Tim Doyle, and today we're joined on the podcast by San Francisco coach Todd Golden. And coach, you're one of the youngest head coaches at the Division I level. Do you feel that's an edge for you recruiting-wise because you can relate to the players a little bit better?
Sometimes, you know, I think sometimes it helps. You know, I'm pretty good on the text game and pretty up to date with social media. And I feel, you know, there's definitely been some guys where I feel like I've been able to build a good relationship with because of my ability to, you know what they're into and know what's important to them. And I think at times it's helped. And then at other times when I'm going up against guys that have been in the game for 20 years and won a lot more than I have, it hasn't exactly been a big advantage. So I try to cherry pick it when I can.
I take us into a deep dive of the text game. Are you an emoji guy? Are you a GIF guy? Like, do you get creative in that way?
No, I'm more like a relentless texter, I would say, at times. You know, I feel like I just can put the full court press on, and at times I'm probably annoying that way. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
I talked to an older guy in business, and he said, now with text messaging, it allows you to communicate without, like, old school getting on the phone. You know, I remember, like, my parents used to put me on my phone with, like, my aunt down in Florida who I never saw. And I was like, thanks, Aunt Louise, for, like, it was, like, that awkward. Like, now you can communicate with Aunt Louise. She can see pictures of your kids. Like, now the communication level is, you know, so much more sophisticated. How has recruiting changed from how you were recruited at a player at St. Mary's to maybe what you do now?
Yeah, I think, you know, that little breakdown you just gave was similar. You know, I think back in the day, you always had to catch somebody on the phone. And that was, you know, for a young student athlete in high school that's, you know, playing in summer leagues or, you know, going to practice every day and you know, going to school. It was a lot more difficult to catch people. And I think back then you could only make one phone call a week to a prospective student athlete. Whereas now it's just, you know, it's a free for all that way. And the text message is definitely, you know, it makes it a little more intrusive for the young kids. And I think that's a little difficult because you can hit them at any time. But at the same time, for these young men and women that are being recruited, they can also put their phone down, you know, and stay away from it that way. So it's obviously easier to connect. I think, I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it definitely has allowed us coaches to have more of a broad reach in regards to who we're trying to recruit and how we're recruiting them.
In 2019, San Francisco promoted you from within to be the head coach. How are you able to sell the program on keeping the hire internal?
You know what? I think the main thing was, and I got to give Kyle Smith a lot of credit because he did a really nice job when we got here. Of kind of getting this program back on the right track. And for the administration, both on the athletic and the academic side, they really liked what the program was doing. And for them, it was more of a continuity thing. They wanted to make sure all the young men in our program would stick around. You know, they wanted to make sure that we could continue the trajectory. And to them, it was a little bit of a risk to open it up and bring somebody else in because it was a little bit, in any case, it was, and when you do that, it's starting over in a sense, and they wanted to really just keep it going. And so fortunately for me, you know, I'd built good relationships with the young men in our program. And obviously Kyle and I were really close from our time when he coached me at St. Mary's and when I worked with him at Columbia. So that it was an easy transition that way, and knock on wood, you know, it was pretty seamless and we were able to keep all the young men in our program.
Dive into the analytics a little bit. You've been known to use them. Why is that something you prioritize in your program?
You know, I think it's important for us, you know, here at San Francisco to try to gain every incremental advantage that we can. And so, you know, we always just try to put ourselves in the best position to be successful. And when you take the human element out of it as much as you can in certain situations and rely on what you know from a mathematical standpoint gives you the best chance, you know, it's going to give you the best chance. It's going to give you the best advantage. So whether it's, you know, fouling, you know, a poor free throw shooter in the 1-on-1 or trying to get a 2-for-1, you know, those are the things that are going to give you the best chance. And they don't always work out, but you have to trust that when you do those things, you're just giving your team a better chance to win the ball game.
Yeah, you've just made me so happy because I'll announce 20, 30, you know, college basketball games. I also announce NBA games. And the college game drives me insane, Coach, when there's 48 on the game clock, 30 on the shot clock. I know I went to Northwestern, so maybe the level of education is a little bit higher than these other college coaches, but it's pretty simple. We can take two shots. You're only going to get one. But why is it that college coaches are so reluctant to kind of give away that power?
You know what? First of all, flow of game, I think, is something that, you know, coaches sometimes take a little too, I don't want to say personally, but it changes the way they think about it. You know, like I'll give last Saturday when we were playing St. Mary's as an example, we weren't, you know, they played great in the first half and they were up 9 or 10 points late in the first half. And we had an advantage, an opportunity to take a 2-for-1. And we did. In fact, we got our best, you know, our best player got our mid-range layup that he missed. They came down, their front court player that doesn't shoot threes made a three. And then we came down and missed a three. So we ended up getting crushed in the 2-for-1, but it was the right move. And regardless.
But if you guys would have shot later in the clock, they would have still had a possession. Anyway, they were getting the ball regardless. So you actually got two possessions on that play. You just didn't convert on it. And that's just simple basketball. But the math of it, they're going to get the ball anyway. It's like, I am shocked. The NBA is so good at it, and they have multiple chances, right? They have three quarters. With the halves, it's pretty easy. It's only going to happen maybe most twice a game.
Correct. No, I think it's one of those things where you really have to have that mindset going into the game, right? Because when you get into the game and all the emotions and all the ups and downs of the way the first half has gone, you have to be able to stick to your guns and realize like, hey, you know, this is something that we've thought about all summer and fall. You know, we're going to take advantage of the clock when we can. And you got to roll with it regardless of how the game's going, regardless of whether you're up 10 or down 10. It's the right move to get two shots against their one. I think Daryl Morey had a quote from a while ago where he said two bad shots is better than one good shot any day of the week. And, you know, that's kind of the creed and the motto that we live by in those situations.
Yeah, I love it. And I played at Princeton for Bill Carmody, and obviously he learned from Pete Carril. And they were so far ahead of the curve with, you know, shooting the three and stuff. And then now everyone's kind of shifted towards that. He wasn't doing the analytics of it. But when I finished playing, you know, I played at a very high level 3-on-3. Right. And there it was 2 points versus 1 point. So then it came to a point of why are we shooting any 1 points unless you're shooting a layup? So I've been on the high level of those analytical conversations, and it's like a light bulb went off. And I had pretty high basketball IQ. Bill Carmody and that offense and his thought philosophy took it to another level. I don't know the analytics as well because I'm not in those huddles. But could you maybe take us under the hood a little bit and give us maybe 30,000 feet overview of maybe something you find to be most compelling from an analytical standpoint?
In regards to like in-game or in?
Yeah, just you want us to have any situation that's going to sound interesting, because to be honest with you, it's a little over my head, but I'm curious to hear it.
Well, you know, what kind of what you were just talking about, like in regards to, you know, the 3-on-3 game and ones and twos, right? I mean, it's a little bit of the same in basketball where threes are worth 1.5, you know, what a 2-pointer is worth. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we try to do here, and we try to be one of the best in the country at it, is playing the 3-point game a little bit. And, you know, obviously our roster has dictated that we are a 5-out team. And so we play pretty spread out and we shoot a ton of threes. You know, we shoot, I think top 5 or 10, the amount of threes in the country. And then conversely on the defensive side, we try to limit threes as much as possible. And I think we're top 10 in the country at limiting 3-point attempts. And, you know, it's really a numbers game. You know, if you get more threes and they're good shots and you limit the opponent's 3-point attempts, I mean, that's just more opportunities to score points over the course of the ball game. And generally speaking, you know, when we shoot the ball well, we win. And so it's pretty simple that way, but a lot of people struggle with that. And sometimes, you know, if we had better inside presence scoring the ball, like the numbers might equate differently, and we might play more inside out. You know, we're going to do whatever analytically we feel like is going to give us the best chance to win. But for this team in this year, you know, winning the 3-point game is something that we try to do on every night.
Take us inside of when you're out recruiting, right? And you're looking at someone who could necessarily be a fit for the style of play and, you know, kind of looking at the analytics and having a unique skill set. What's something that you look for in a young recruit?
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, there's a couple of different buckets, you know, in regards to what we're evaluating. And at San Francisco, this is a good school. And so we want guys that are really good students. You know, I think that helps, especially with our style of play in terms of understanding, you know, what we're trying to do. So from an off the court standpoint, really it's academics and character. You know, those are the two main things that we're trying to check off before we even dive into the basketball piece. And then, you know, from a basketball standpoint, really, we are just trying to find the best basketball players we can, regardless of size, shape, position. And then, you know, I feel like it's my job to get the best players we can and then put them into the position to be successful. So whether we're able to get really good post players and then, you know, build a 3-round-2 team, or whether it's what we are now, which is more of a perimeter oriented attack where we're playing, you know, 4 and 5 out most every night, where we're just trying to spread the floor and play. It's less about recruiting to a system fit, more about recruiting the best players we feel like we can get, and then molding the way we play around them.
You were a pretty good player yourself at St. Mary's. Do you think, when you look at it from the grand scheme of thing, as a point guard, that point guards make the best coaches?
I think it helps. I really do. I don't know if, you know, there's some examples of great coaches that weren't point guards, whether it's, you know, Larry Bird type, or even though he was kind of a point forward, but he was, you know, I do think for whatever reason, that connection of playing the game, you know, from a young age, trying to being a team leader, and also the relationship that you form as a student athlete with your coaches at the point guard position. And Coach Bennett was great that way. Coach Kyle Smith, the same with me at St. Mary's. You know, I felt like I was always the leader on the floor for them, and the coach on the floor, for the lack of a better term. And they definitely helped me understand and learn the game a lot over my 5 years at St. Mary's. And so I don't know if it's just that natural growth from being, you know, the captain type player, or being the connection of the coach on the floor to becoming a coach or whatever it is. But I do think, for whatever reason, you know, point guards generally do grow to be coaches more than any other position.
You went from being a point guard, then all of a sudden you're the director of basketball operations at Columbia. So what did you learn from that operations side that now helps you at all as a head coach?
You know what? I think I was actually director of basketball ops there at Columbia. And then my first year at Auburn, I was director of ops with Bruce Pearl. And even before I got into coaching, I worked in sales and marketing for 2 years back here in San Francisco at IMG. And then also at Comcast Sportsnet. And I think the business side of sport, whether it be from a sales perspective or from a operations perspective with budgeting and travel and meals and all these different things, it just gives you a great broad perspective of the profession and of college basketball. And there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, my 2 years as operations gave me a much better understanding of what this head coaching position entails. And I think a lot of coaches that, whether they skip that step or just they never have that operations time, they don't have as good of a feel for it. And I think it's hard to, when you do become a head coach, understand obviously recruiting and coaching are the most important things. But at the end of the day, if you're not great in the operations side, you're going to miss the boat on a lot of things. And I do think it's helped me have a better understanding of what makes a Division I program successful.
You know, we've had a bunch of coaches here that have had such unique journeys, and hearing yours, right? You have a real job, day job, right? You're working inside of TV, you're working at IMG, then you're going into coaching, you're living in Harlem, then you're living in California. I mean, you've really been all over the place. But, you know, we've talked to guys like Brad Underwood and Shaka Smart and Roy Williams, and everyone kind of has a different journey. Yours was, some would say, fast track. Not that you didn't work hard, but you have a really great job at a young age. Is there any feeling when you're around other coaches that they kind of look at you like, oh, that young guy?
You know, when my first head coaches meeting at the WCC last spring or two springs ago, whatever it was now, I remember sitting at the conference table and I'm looking around, and, you know, Mark Few is to my left and my head coach, Randy Bennett's right in front of me. And then Lorenzo Romar is, you know, diagonal to me. And then Herb Sendek is to my right. And then Terry Porter and Mike Dunlap, who both were NBA head coaches, are in there. And then Damon Stoudemire, who is an incredible player and has done a great job at Pacific, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, you know, this is pretty cool. You know, this is pretty neat. And I'm sure some of them were looking at me like, man, what's this kid doing here? You know, it's been pretty amazing that way. And I'm sure across the country, people like are wondering, you know, Golden, you know, got lucky or Golden did this, but you know,
yeah, but does that drive you? I mean, that's an honest question. I mean, I was on Big Ten Network at 24 years old. I had a unique path broadcasting. I was calling games with Brian Anderson or Gus Johnson. And I felt that as a broadcaster, and right. I could tell older guys were kind of like, you know, rolling their eyes at the opportunity that I was, you know, given or I earned, however you want to look at it. Do you feel a little bit like that?
You know, I don't feel like there's any animosity, so to speak. It definitely motivates me to try to be the best I can be. And I don't want to let anybody down. I don't want anybody to feel like I wasn't ready for this opportunity. And, you know, I feel like we as a staff work pretty hard to make sure that we're always prepared and we're always doing the best we can. And obviously there's ups and downs, and there's times where I feel like we're doing a great job, and there's times where I feel like we're not doing well enough. And it definitely continues to motivate us and myself to do the best we can and to make sure we're putting our student athletes in the best position to be successful.
So now as a head coach, has a referee ever referenced you as a young guy or a kid, or have you ever had a heated debate with a ref where maybe they call out your age?
It was pretty funny actually, because in the game last Saturday, and I won't say who the ref was, but he came up to me before the game and he said something to me along the lines of, hey, you know, you were a big pain in the ASS to ref for last year, but I've had a couple of your games this year and I enjoy working with you a lot more now. And I do think there's a little bit of that at times. Where, you know, I have yet to receive a technical, so that's something that I'm proud of. But I know there's times where some of the veteran refs, and out here in the West, I get a bunch of refs that were reffing when I was playing, you know, so they've seen that natural progression of my career, and I'm sure they're tired of hearing my voice sometimes and don't want to hear it from a younger guy, but I don't feel like it's been too much of a disadvantage to this point.
You know, casual fans, and I use the word casual because they'll look at the WCC and see Gonzaga. No offense, I know you play at St. Mary's, but they see Gonzaga and then they see Gonzaga and they, you know, they keep seeing Gonzaga. Like, there's more to the league if you know college hoops. Obviously, you know that playing there. But what sets the WCC apart from other quote-unquote small school leagues?
Man, I think the WCC is one of the most underrated leagues in the country, if you can say that about a top 10 league. You know, I think in KenPom, we're ninth best league in the country. And what's the most unique about it since from my playing days, it's so much deeper than it was when I played. You know, back in the early to mid 2000s, you know, Gonzaga was starting to really get going, but they weren't number one in the country. You know, they were top 40, top 25 at best, you know, and, you know, we at St. Mary's, we're starting to kind of get going. We played in two tournaments when I was there, but, you know, even my middle 2 years, we were about 100th on KenPom. Like, we weren't elite by any means. And then everybody was kind of playing for third and we only had eight teams in the league. So now fast forward 15 years. And I think right now we have eight teams in the top 130 or 140 in the net and on KenPom, and the depth of the league is just insane. You know, you're not going into other people's gyms like we were in 2005 thinking we were going to win pretty easily. You know, you're going to LMU or you're going to Pepperdine, and those games are incredibly difficult to win. So just the depth of the league is something that's incredibly underrated, I would say, nationally, and people within our conference really understand it now.
You play with a ton of, let's just say, guys from different backgrounds at St. Mary's, right? I mean, how many Aussies were on your team there?
We had, you know, I think 1 year we had seven or eight, you know, and at least four or five throughout the course of my tenure.
Was it mostly Aussies? And that's going to kind of lead into my next question. Were there guys from Europe and stuff, or was it mostly from Australia?
You know, that my time at St. Mary's was dominated by, you know, Bay Area guys and Australian players, you know, and the occasional kid from Phoenix, myself and Mickey McConnell, who's now an assistant at St. Mary's. But especially right after I left, I think there was 1 year where they had 7 or 8 guys from Australia.
Yeah. So do you go down under? Do you peek down there yourself for guys?
You know what? We have one, Josh Coonan, who's turning out to be a really, really nice player. And, you know, it just so happened, you know, St. Mary's can't take them all. And there's some that go to different places.
Does that go on? Does Coach Bennett call you and be like, hey, I might have a guy for you?
No, he's definitely not helping us. He's working against us for sure. But like I said, you know, they only have 3 or 4 every year that they can take. And there's, you know, there's great players down there. It's a big country. And the center of excellence where Adam Capehorn, who played at St. Mary's, you know, he's the head coach there now, has done a really nice job. So we'll try to go down there at times. We know what we're up against, especially now, because back in the mid 2000s, besides, you know, Andrew Bogut going to Utah or Andrew Ogilvie going to Vanderbilt, a lot of those guys honed in on going to St. Mary's, whereas now they still get a ton, but I feel like it's opened up a little bit to other, you know, schools across the country in regards to recruiting that landscape. So I feel like we can go down there and at least pull one every year or two that can help us out.
I've been to Australia, the Big Ten All-Star team. We traveled there going into my senior year. So we practiced in Ann Arbor and then we flew to Australia. So from Ann Arbor to Australia, that flight's a beast. You know, yeah. You guys are obviously cutting that in half because you're already out, right, out west. But when we went down there, I was floored by the physicality of them. The Aussies, they play that Aussie Leagues football, and it's just there's a toughness to their game, which I respected, and I played a similar style. But I think it would be hilarious, Coach, if that you're down in Australia somewhere, there's like kangaroos running around, and then you run into Randy Bennett and recruiting the same guy. It'd be like Nick Nolte trying to find Shaq in Blue Chips or something.
Man, I'll tell you, you know, the one of the better memories I have as a player was we went on our foreign tour at St. Mary's to Australia. And a big reason why was because we had a young man named Daniel Kickert, who ended up being, I think he's now second all time leading scorer at St. Mary's. And it was a little bit of an ode to him to go back and play some games and visit there. And we played at the time, it was called the Australian Institute of Sport, which is now the Center of Excellence, which was their, you know, their youth program that was building up their great young talents. And so we played this team that was mostly 17, 18 year old kids. And we were, you know, college kids, and they came out and they punched us in the mouth early, and they had a really good guard that was, you know, tearing us up. And I remember at one of the timeouts, Coach Bennett just ripped into me and said, Golden, if you ever want to be a player, you're going to have to be able to beat high school kids. You know, this is embarrassing, you know, get it going. Da, da, da. And we ended up coming back and we played well, we won by 20. Well, that kid ended up being Patty Mills. So he ended up being a dang good player to be his teammate for a year at St. Mary's. But, you know, the talent there was great, and it's something that's continued for 15 or so years.
Last question for you, and we appreciate you joining the podcast. Besides Coach Bennett and Coach Smith, obviously those guys have been mentors to you. Who do you look at nationally, maybe respected their programs from afar, appreciated their coaching styles? Who's someone that stands out to you?
You know, I said this, and it was just kind of crazy that we ended up matching up with him, and even crazier that we beat him. But Tony Bennett at Virginia is...
You look like if I dim my eyes a little bit, like you got the dark hair. You guys could be clones for crying out loud. He might have been better than you. He did have a little cup of coffee in the NBA.
Sure. No, I'll tell you, man, I've just been so impressed. You know, I being a West Coast guy, I watched him very closely at Washington State, you know, as I was finishing up playing and in my first couple years in coaching. And I just always loved watching his teams play up there. They were grimy and gritty, super defensive oriented, but he always put guys like Clay or Taylor Rochesty or Kyle Weaver in positions to be really successful. And then he took the Virginia job, and it took a while for them to really kind of get his guys on the bus. And then the way they took off after his first couple years was incredible. And what I'm always impressed with Coach Bennett is, you know, they've started to get some guys that are 4- and 5-star recruits, but they're not knocking down, you know, top 10, 20 recruits. They're getting guys that really fit their program and their style, and more their just their atmosphere of their, what they want their program to be. Guys like a guy like a Kahi Clark, who was a low major, you know, signee that, and they ended up getting, and they just go and roll people. You know, they won by 23 again last night, and just their continuity and consistency is something that I've always, you know, really admired. And that's what I told him this after we played him, like, we are trying to build what you have built, you know, and we're a long ways away from it, but I feel like we're in the right direction. And I feel like we're trending to get towards that way, hopefully in a few years. But you know, he's someone that I definitely look up to and admire.
Yeah. He's someone I admire just as a father. Now I have two kids, and the way he handled not winning a national title, that doesn't impress me. The way he handled losing to UMBC and the things he said after the game and post game, and then the bounce back, right? It's almost like you to get the guys to kind of believe again, it just shows you what type of coach he is. I think that's a great example. I know I said this is the last question, but I have to have one more. Sure. Because for a living, I call games. I have my own perception of Gonzaga. It's no one's going to beat them. They're going to win a national championship. What's your perception of Gonzaga this year, as far as you've seen a lot of great teams? You know the league, yeah, arguably as well as anybody. You played there. I know this isn't a Gonzaga show, but is there a massive differential in this year's team than any other team you've seen before?
You know what, Tim? It's funny because I'll be honest. Going into the season, you know, everybody's like, oh, you know, this Gonzaga team has a chance to be the best team they've had. And then after they won their first couple of games, people are saying that. And I mean, we got an up close look at them three times last year when they were starting Petrušev and Tilly at the four and the five, and had great fifth year guards and Ryan Woolridge and Gilder, and Kispert was playing 32 minutes a game. And then they were bringing Drew Timmy off the bench, you know, right. And I'm thinking like, man, they were pretty dang good last year. Like, it's going to be tough for them to be exceedingly better than what they were last year. But with all that being said, I do think, you know, at this point, I would say this is their best team, because they're just so hard to guard. And I think last year there was ways you could kind of game plan them when they're playing two bigs to maybe, you know, sag off and pack the paint a little bit and bother them. But, you know, what Coach Few has done this year, playing Corey at the four a little more and just really spreading you out, they pass the ball better than any team I've ever seen. And in transition, they attack you better than any team, and they cut and pass interior wise better than any team. And they just never let you off the hook. And I think that's something that makes them better than anybody else, is I feel like if you make one defensive mistake in a 30-second shot clock, they're just scoring. Like, they're not missing, they're just scoring. And it makes it really, really hard. And we went up there already this year and we played great for the first 19 minutes of the game. We were down three with like a minute and 15 seconds to go in the first half. And I'm thinking, all right, get this thing to halftime down five or less, and we can maybe get them on their toes a little bit in the second half. Next thing you know, it was a 10-point game at halftime, and we're just scratching our head, like, how did that happen? So I do think this is a team because their guard play is fantastic. Yayi, you know, they bring Nembhard off the bench sometimes. Jalen Suggs, top five pick. And then Kispert, I think, should be a lottery pick. He's one of the best players.
Agree. Yeah, I agree. I agree with the Kispert thing. Yeah, I watched him really closely against Virginia. It's funny, we were just talking about Tony Bennett. And that was one of those games that if you watch basketball for a long time, it went to the first time out, and I went, oh, no, Virginia's going to be in big trouble in this game. And they haven't scored 100 against the Cavaliers. And this is a Tony Bennett-led team. And they're keeping people in the 50s, keeping people in the 60s. Gonzaga has got 100 against them. So I appreciate your insight. I know it's got to be a little weird to talk about another team, but as far as your conference, I mean, it's got to be kind of cool that you have a team that, you know, is the favorite right now to win it all.
You know, it's you can look at it one of two ways, honestly. And the way I think about it, I think it's great for the league. I think it's great for us. There's no doubt that them having so much success has shined a bigger light on our conference. Obviously, it's helped us get better TV exposures. You know, like we've played on ESPN three or four times this year, which is something that's never happened before, you know, and a part of that is a trickle down effect of Gonzaga being so good. And that just helps our whole league. So yeah, I mean, it's tough to climb to the top of the mountain in this league. You know, you're not knocking down a top 25 program. It's number one. But at the same time, it gives us a great goal to shoot for. And it definitely, I think, gives our league a great chance to continue to have multi-bids in the NCAA tournament.
Well, Coach, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much. You were awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Tim. I'll talk to you soon.
And thanks for tuning in to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. We'll be back next time with another intriguing guest, maybe a little bit older than Coach Golden. Maybe not. Who knows? Come on back.